The Guardian.
You are looking at a live view of the Falcon Heavy. Yes, the Falcon Heavy on historic pad 39A at Kennedy Space Center, awaiting liftoff at 3:45 p.m. local time. Welcome to our live launch.
On Tuesday, the 6th of February this year, SpaceX launched the first ever test flight of the Falcon Heavy rocket.
At liftoff, Falcon Heavy is going to be the world's most powerful operational rocket by a factor of two. And today is the day that we attempt to demonstrate that power. And because it is a test flight, there is no satellite.
Thousands of people gathered in Florida to watch the launch.
10, 9, 8,
side booster ignition.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition.
On board was a cherry red Tesla car, complete with a dummy driver affectionately named Starman. On the stereo, Space Oddity was put on repeat. And so, David Bowie blasted Starman towards Mars. One day, a rocket like this could launch much more than a doll. It could take people to Mars, a vision that Elon Musk believes is important to ensure the survival of the human race.
But I think a moon base and a Mars base that could perhaps help regenerate life back here on Earth would be really important, and to get that done before a possible World War III.
But should humans be setting their sights on the red planet? If life exists on Mars, could we contaminate it? And should we not try to save the Earth before colonising other planets? I'm Hannah Devlin, and this is Science Weekly.
Hi, my name's Sahan Barmal, and I'm an occasional science blogger for The Guardian in a personal capacity.
Sahan recently wrote an article for The Guardian on the case against Mars colonisation. It got a huge response in the comments section, with people weighing in on both sides of the argument.
Exploration, yes, by all means, but exploration by humans, no.
Don't the morons who say, let's fix the Earth first, not realise that the research and technology that would be used to colonise Mars could also be used to fix the Earth?
We already have technological solutions to most of the existential threats facing us here on Earth. What's lacking is the political will to enact them.
Well, that's a rather depressing and visionless conclusion, that we should stay stuck to the surface of planet Earth.
As for Mars, it's a red, dead planet that's far, far away.
The argument that even in the event of an apocalypse on Earth, it would still be more hospitable than Mars kind of seals the deal for me. That's a very compelling argument for only sending robots to Mars.
Leaving for Mars ought to be a priority. We're only one nuclear war or one asteroid impact away from extinction.
Given the reaction, we thought this question warranted a closer look. So my colleague Ian Sample sat down with Sahan, first to discuss why some argue that humans should go to Mars.
Well, depending on who you talk to, there are a number of reasons. There are some who argue survival. In the event of an apocalyptic scenario on Earth, Mars could provide salvation for the human species. There are some that argue about the search for life and that humans would be uniquely placed to look for evidence of life on Mars. There are some that argue for technological progress and just the act, the process of getting to Mars could stimulate innovation in ways that we may not be able to even predict right now. And then there are those who argue just purely for exploration. We go to Mars because it's next, the same reason we cross the ocean, climb the mountain, take to the skies. Mars is there. Mars is the next destination for humankind.
We almost have this obsession with Mars, though, and I don't know if that's just because it's the next rock out. What do you think underpins that sort of human focus on Mars as the place to go?
Well, I mean, the obsession with Mars is certainly not new. You know, the Roman god of war, Galileo's observations, Cassini's observations, the fact that it's visible from Earth with the naked eye, its colour red, the colour of fire and blood, has always evoked this very emotional response. And it's interesting to remember that not too long ago, before the Mariner missions, people genuinely thought that there could be vegetation and life on the planet. It was only when those photographs came back from the Mariner missions that it was revealed that the surface was actually quite barren.
Mars may be barren today, but it could still harbour remnants of life. And for many, it's this that makes the case for going to Mars so compelling.
I think if we did find evidence of life on Mars, of Martians, it would be the most significant scientific discovery of the last 100 years. My name's Professor Lewis Dartnell, and I'm an astrobiology researcher at the University of Westminster.
I didn't know you were a professor. Congratulations. That's amazing. So I also don't have to commute up. Lewis's specific area of interest is microbial life on Mars. So you could say he's hedged his career on it being there. But what's the evidence for this?
Well, the more that we've learnt about Mars with all of the probes and missions we've sent there, the more Earth-like it seems to have been, at least in its early history. It was much once warmer and wetter and a habitable environment that could have supported its own genesis of life. There could have been an origin of life on Mars. And although the surface it's suffered this kind of catastrophic and environmental collapse, the surface of Mars is now incredibly inhospitable. So perhaps life on the surface of Mars has fallen extinct, and we might just find fossils. There is still a possibility that Mars could have life beneath its surface, a kind of a hidden biosphere, if you like. And that's what we're currently looking for in terms of astrobiology.
And this possibility is also the reason why we should think hard about sending people to Mars.
People are inherently mucky things. We are full of bacteria in, on and around us. And we're constantly kind of leaking that bacterial life, dripping that bacterial life into our environment. So as soon as we send humans to Mars, that bacteria, that kind of bioload, would be leaking out of the habitat into the Martian environment. And so if you're looking for signs of Martian life, you kind of want to have not potentially contaminated the surface of Mars with terrestrial life.
We've already sent several robots up to Mars. Can we be sure that we've not already contaminated it?
Well, robots and machines are much, much easier to clean and sterilise than a person is. But we also know that is practically an impossibility. There will always be some spores or some bacteria that have kind of clung on. It's just trying to reduce that possibility as much as possible.
And this might sound like a stupid question, but why is it so bad for us to leave a few germs if we go up there? What is that going to make it more hard to find the life, or could it kind of wreak environmental havoc if there is some life under the surface?
Well, the first point to make is if you are looking for signs of bacteria on Mars, you want to make absolutely certain that the cells or the organisms you find there are native, they're indigenous, that they're Martian bacteria, and not some lab tech's sneeze when he sneezed on the rover before you launched it. So you want to make sure the thing you are looking for is Martian rather than contamination. But also there's this idea of, for the moment, trying to preserve Mars as a kind of a nature reserve, that there is Martian life there. We shouldn't be contaminating it with terrestrial bacteria.
You mentioned that idea of the lab technician's sneeze being misinterpreted as, you know, the first life discovered on Mars. But wouldn't there be telltale differences between life on Earth and life on Mars, and wouldn't we be able to spot that it was familiar in terms of its genome?
Well, it is a really good point, but we don't really know yet. We've not yet discovered Martian life, so we don't know how it's built. We don't know how it functions under the bonnet. And it might be the case that the way that we work, terrestrial life, that system might be the only way that you can create life. We don't know that that's the case. So if we find Martian life, we will know for certain if it is indigenous, if it's truly alien, if it works in a very different way, if it doesn't use DNA, if it doesn't use proteins. But actually, one of the most frustrating discoveries might be is we do find life on Mars and realise it's actually uncannily similar to us. Does that mean that life on Earth and Mars arose independently and just happens to be built in the same way? Does it mean that we've just discovered our own contamination from the lab tech? Or could it be the third option, which the reason that life on Mars and Earth is suspiciously similar, because in fact it is the same thing, that Earth and Mars have contaminated each other, but not with our robots and during the space race, perhaps billions of years ago. And during this early epoch of the solar system, when all the rubble was left lying around from the making of the planets, was this late heavy bombardment, and there was a lot of asteroids and impacts crashing down onto the inner planets. And if life got started back then, it could have very easily been transferred between inner planets inside a meteorite. So like the planets of Earth and Mars were just sneezing in each other's faces, and have been doing so since that early period of our solar system's history. So the fact that Martian life might be so similar to us could be we just found our own long-lost cousins. Life got started on Earth, transferred to Mars aboard a meteorite, and got a foothold there. But the opposite is also possible. Maybe life got started on Mars earlier than it did on Earth, and then hitchhiked Earth to inoculate our young virgin planet after it soon formed. So maybe we are the Martians already. Maybe we are the descendants of those immigrants that came to Earth aboard a meteorite. Now, it'd be very difficult to tease apart those different possibilities if life on Earth and Mars are shown to be very, very similar.
If there is evidence of life on Mars, and we want to be able to unpick where it came from, we need to be very careful about sending humans there. And this is where robotic missions have the upper hand. There are currently 8 active robotic missions on Mars. Next month, a 9th will be added to that list, NASA's Mars InSight Lander. And they have taught us a lot about our rocky neighbour, Zahana explains to Ian.
Well, certainly the robotic missions to date have revealed a lot. So take, for example, the European Space Agency's Mars Express, which a few months ago confirmed that there is, in fact, liquid water beneath the caps, which is a huge discovery. Mars Curiosity, the NASA rover, recently celebrated its 6th birthday, and it's discovered evidence of varying levels of methane, which could potentially be a signal for life. It's not definitive, but it could be one of the markers for life. So certainly the robotic missions have taught us a lot.
But there are drawbacks, presumably, from just sending robotic missions.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Ellen Soffan, she's the new director of the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., and she used to be NASA's chief scientist. I read that she recently testified to the Senate subcommittee, and she was asked that very question, humans versus robots, and she gave a great answer, I thought. She argued that if there is life on Mars, it's almost certainly going to be difficult to find, and there's going to be a limit to what robots can do. You need scientists actually there breaking open rocks, looking. And moreover, you need those scientists looking at the bigger picture, looking at sort of complex trends and nuances and variations comparing Mars to Earth. And so there's going to be a limit, she argues, to what robots alone can do, and there's no substitute for the human intuition. But then there's, of course, sort of an argument that robots and humans together could be the best combo. Robots could be the ones in the dangerous situations on the surface collecting the rocks, and then humans could be the ones in the laboratory somewhere.
It is an enormous technological challenge to get there. Well, to get there with people in a good enough condition to be useful when they arrive, and obviously they will then need somewhere to be when they arrive on the surface. Take us through how big a challenge that is. What needs to be done?
In the first instance, there's the journey to Mars. So putting costs aside, you've got a couple of big challenges. One is radiation. Any astronauts making the journey to Mars would be exposed to very high levels of solar radiation outside the protective atmosphere of the Earth. And then there's also the challenge of what one might describe as restlessness, boredom, the psychological impact of being alone in a capsule in the darkness of space for several months at a time. So that's the journey to Mars. And then once you get to Mars, certainly conditions don't get that much easier. Radiation is still a big challenge. Radiation on the surface would be over 100 times the radiation one would experience on Earth. One third the gravity that you have on Earth, which could have long-term effects on bone density and strength. And then if they ever were to return to Earth, it's unknown what impact it would have on their body. So it's certainly a very tough place.
And the issues Zahan lays out here don't touch on how we could sustain human habitation. We'd need shelter, oxygen, water, food. And whilst there have been efforts to address those issues, there are still a lot of open questions. It's here that robots have another inherent advantage. They don't need water or food or oxygen. and they're cheap when compared to the billions it would cost to send humans to Mars. But could robots make that definitive discovery and say, yes, life exists on Mars? Or do we need to send humans to confirm its existence?
An astronaut with a geological rock hammer strolling across the Martian landscape before breakfast could do more than any one of these robots in their entire mission.
After the break, we'll be speaking to Zahan and Lewis about the role of robots and artificial intelligence in astrobiology. Could they be clever enough to save us the journey? We'll be back in a minute after this.
I'm Lee Lendening, and in this month's We Need to Talk About podcast, our panel respond to Guardian supporter questions on extinction. How can conservation be balanced with the hunger for development? With finite conservation resources, how can we decide which species to save, and who should decide this? And what can we do to support biodiversity in our local area?
This is a massive economic assault by one species on the lives of all the other 8 to 10 million.
We look into pesticides and tourism, on the efforts to save the Sumatran orangutan, Dorset hedgehogs, Belizean national parks, and much more. That's We Need to Talk About Extinction. To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we pondered the problems of sending humans to Mars, namely that our earthly microbes could contaminate the red planet. A potential solution to this is to send robotic missions instead. But could robots definitively answer this question of whether or not there is life on Mars? Here's Lewis Dartnell again.
I mean, the most recent robots we're sending to Mars now, and the year 2020 is going to be a very exciting year for Mars exploration, because both ESA, the European Space Agency, is sending the ExoMars rover, and NASA is sending their Mars 2020 rover. But they are both equipped specifically to search for signs of life on Mars. And these robots are incredibly sophisticated, with an entire suite of different instruments and equipment to look for organic molecules and signs of life. But nonetheless, it is true that an astronaut with a geological rock hammer strolling across the Martian landscape before breakfast could do more than any one of these robots in their entire mission. We are intelligent scientists. We can spot things that stand out or look anomalous or don't quite make sense. We can crack them open with a hammer. We can then use instruments to look at them ourselves. But what I suspect would be the best way of going about it is not trying to miniaturize an entire laboratory to slap a set of wheels underneath and put some solar panels on top and launch that as a rover to Mars, but to bring Mars to the Earth, to send a robot in a Mars sample return mission, it's called, grab what looked to be the most interesting samples of soil from underground and rocks on the surface, and then launch them all the way back to the Earth. Because then we can use all of the laboratories around the world with the latest techniques to scrutinise that Martian dirt to look for organic molecules and the signs of life.
Mightn't it be in 10, 15, 20 years' time, with the kind of rapid advances in robots and AI, that we will have some form of robot that will be just as intelligent in terms of searching for life and just as well equipped to do that job as a human would be?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the main reason why I would urge caution and not to rush to Mars in the next 10, 15, 20 years with humans. If we wait just another decade or two, as you say, robotic technology, which is advancing incredibly quickly at the moment, could start getting into the range of capabilities of a human.
Ian also spoke to Zahan Barmal about this, as well as the risk of human contamination.
One of my childhood heroes, Carl Sagan, even wrote about this in Cosmos. He says that if there is life on Mars, even microbial life, then we should leave Mars to the Martians. We should leave it be. Which is a very compelling argument.
It's a bit of a catch-22 that Carl Sagan raises, though, isn't it? He's saying, if there's any kind of life there, we should leave it to that kind of life, even if it's just microbes. But it may be difficult for us to find out if there's any kind of life without going there, digging the place up, having a lot of labs there and doing a lot of wet chemistry and going through and trying to find some kind of signatures for this. And it seems quite a restrictive approach. I totally understand the emotional motive for that statement, but doesn't that restrict us a little bit in terms of where we can explore in the solar system and who knows beyond?
That's a great question. And this isn't a new issue for NASA, that it's had policies on planetary protection for the better part of 60 years, and it's actually in the process of updating those policies, given that we're now entering this new era of exploration. For me, the takeaway is that this is an important issue, and I'm reassured that NASA is looking again at its policies on planetary protection. I don't necessarily think that the risk of contamination needs to be a complete showstopper when it comes to human exploration of Mars, but I think it's a really important issue. And if you were to tell me that humans were planning to land on Mars tomorrow, I may be more concerned. But given that we're looking at a timeline, you know, depending on who you ask, if you ask NASA, it's sort of the mid-2030s, I feel more reassured that in that timescale, there's more opportunity to really thoughtfully think about those policies on planetary protection and come up with a better answer before it is time for humans to plant those first footprints on the red planet.
I think what Lewis and Zahan have highlighted is the need for clearer guidelines and instructions of how to proceed. And whilst NASA are working on that, the Pew Research Center has been polling American taxpayers to ask what they think of their country's space programs.
They ask people to look at NASA's various priorities, and one of the overarching findings was that there was still huge support for NASA's leadership when it came to space exploration, which was very encouraging. But they asked participants to look at a list of NASA's current priorities and rank them in order of importance. And what came out top were climate change and asteroid detection. And what came out bottom were returning to the moon and going to Mars, which I thought was very interesting. I take it with some pinch of salt and context. I actually went to the cinema last night and I saw First Man, which is amazing, by the way. But the film touched briefly on some of the resistance to the Apollo program back in the 60s, which I thought was fascinating. And I actually found out in 1967, 2 years before the moon landing, there was a Harris poll which showed that 54% of people said putting a man on the moon was not worth it, and only a third thought it was. And 2 years before that, 57% of people in the same Harris poll thought the money would be better spent developing systems for water desalinization. So certainly public resistance to space exploration is not a new phenomenon, but we need to take it in the context.
It's interesting that the top two priority programs, as ranked by US citizens, were monitoring climate change and looking for potential asteroids that might hit the Earth. More broadly, they are both about conserving the Earth as opposed to making a backup planet. And this is one of the most polarising arguments in this debate. Should we invest in saving the Earth instead of strapping ourselves to a $90 million rocket bound for Mars?
I'm not sure that if we hadn't spent the money we'd spent on space exploration over the last 60 years, that the problems on Earth would necessarily be better. And I'm also not sure that if today we were to cut off all spending on space exploration, that the problems we face today would be better, partly because the problems we face aren't necessarily all financial, and some are driven by political will and other factors. As someone who studied science at university many years ago, I also find it a dangerous precedent when we start making decisions and questioning spending on scientific exploration and scientific research, unless it's got an immediate practical benefit, gets into dangerous territory. So I guess net for me, you know, we need to do both. And Earth versus Mars necessarily, it is not necessarily the right question to be asking.
But considering that space missions are paid for by the public, people's views matter. It's their money. And so if they decide, you know what, the idea of spending billions to send a couple of people, a few people to Mars, when you could use that money potentially to do something immediately more valuable on Earth, that can't be ignored.
No, absolutely, and I think it's important, and I definitely don't want to dismiss public views. I mean, I think it's interesting to note that the funding of space exploration is very different to what it was in the 60s. In the 60s, you had two giant superpowers battling for political supremacy. It was a publicly funded endeavor. Today, we're living in a world where space exploration has very much been democratized, and you've got hugely ambitious and exciting private sector players like SpaceX playing alongside the public sector. So that changes the dynamic somewhat. But I agree that you need to find the balance as a public policymaker between giving exploration enough room whilst also respecting the broader views of the public.
And finally, I mean, there could be some sort of catastrophe, unexpected catastrophe that hit Earth, but we're also responsible for the possible catastrophe of climate change in the way we look after the Earth. Is there not a risk that if you have this idea of a backup planet in the back of your head, that you may be going to take less seriously that responsibility of taking care of the planet we're on?
I would hope not, because although Mars might serve as a kind of a backup file, if you like, if we were to crash civilization on Earth, you could only ever send a very small, select group of people to Mars. So if you want to save the 7 or so billion people on Earth today, we could simply not launch them all to Mars. And so in that sense, we still have that overriding obligation and responsibility to try to preserve our environment on Earth, because we will have only one chance at that.
A special thanks to Lewis Dartnell and Zahan Barmal for joining us this week. A link to Zahan's article can be found on our website. Just head over to theguardian.com/podcasts and click on Science Weekly. You can also email us with any thoughts or questions you had about the episode, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. This week, the podcast was produced by Greya Jackson and presented by me, Hannah Devlin. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.